This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large for Sunday, March 18th, 2012. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Madholkar.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ahead, Jacqueline Froelich catches up with two local mutters who are training for Tough Mutter Dallas. And our bird expert, Joe Neal, tracks down an Arctic snowy owl. University of Arkansas's Full Circle Campus Food Pantry is placed second in a nationwide contest launched by the White House. And author Michael Downs talks about his collection of short stories based on the 1944 Hartford Circus Fire.
But first, Wednesday afternoon, I made a trip to downtown Fayetteville to not only find out more about a boot camp program for technology startups, but also be a part of Fayetteville's first Startup Day.
And whereas residents and guests of our community are being asked to celebrate startups and entrepreneurial pursuits in recognition of our great city as an interesting place for starting, operating, and growing new ventures. Now therefore, I, Lionel Jordan, Mayor of the City of Fayetteville, Arkansas, do hereby proclaim Wednesday, March 14, 2012, as Startup Day in the City of Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan was addressing a group of more than 50 people at the Iceberg, a new co-working facility located in the heart of downtown Fayetteville. The proclamation was soon followed by the launch of the ARC, a coordinated initiative to enhance regional competitiveness. Jeanette Baeza, the director of the ARC, explains.
There are actually a lot of different parts and partners to the initiative. There's the ARC Challenge, which is a mentorship-driven business accelerator program for tech entrepreneurs. And then there's also a workforce training and development effort that is trying to figure out what are the new technology skills that are required for this growing sector in technology, and how can we expand our recruitment efforts to find local people here and then equip them with the skill sets of programming for mobile apps or for internet startups.
The initiative has been launched by Windrock International, a nonprofit that seeks to promote economic development and sustainability in partnership with the University of Arkansas and the Northwest Arkansas Community College. The ARC receives funding from three federal agencies, namely Economic Development Administration, the Small Business Administration, and Employment and Training Administration. The initiative also receives financial support from Windrock International and two angel investment firms called Gravity Ventures and Fund for Arkansas's Future. Aside from Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan, the launch event featured other speakers, including Barbara Price Davis from Northwest Arkansas Community College, Mike Malone from Northwest Arkansas Council, and University of Arkansas Chancellor Dr. G. David Gearhart.
Well, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be here today. And Mayor, I want you to know that I brought with me one of our graduate students who happens to be shadowing me today. In addition to her coming in handy on many things that we've been talking about today on my schedule, she also helped me pay the parking out here when I was out here. I just didn't happen to have any cash with me, but I'm good for an hour, Mayor.
Wednesday afternoon's event specifically highlighted the upcoming ARC Challenge, which is a 14-week-long boot camp for technology startup companies and their founders. The program allows them to receive $18,333 in seed funding and advice from experts, mentors, presenters, and investors regarding their product. Again, we hear from Jeanette Baeza, the director of the ARC.
So at the boot camp program, it's 14 weeks of concentrated business acceleration. So every activity that will be happening during that boot camp will relate to customer acquisition or market traction, investor relations, and then also programming and product development. So actually building the product or process that we hope will benefit one or all or some of our three existing clusters in retail, in supply chain, transportation and logistics, and food processing.
The Art Challenge is also a member of the Global Accelerator Network, which seeks to promote economic development through mentorship of entrepreneurs and startups and linking them with knowledge and financial resources. The idea, Baeza says, is to retain homegrown talent.
I remember conversations about the brain drain, like how do we maintain these really sharp graduates that come out of our universities, as well as attract people here in technology to start their own businesses.
According to Baeza, participation in the ARC Challenge will require going through an application process. Once selected, the participants will have to be in Northwest Arkansas for the entire 14-week boot camp. She says the program hopes to attract internet and mobile technology startups.
They could be students, they could be a company that graduated out of a different accelerator and needs help getting to that next level. But anyone who has an incredible concept is willing and excited to have this opportunity to have access to funding and to have complete focus for 14 weeks on making that idea come to fruition.
The ARC Challenge participants will have access to free office space in the Iceberg, in addition to industry research, legal support, marketing services, and a network of experts, mentors, and investors to help start and promote their company. In return, the ARC will hold a 6% equity stake in each startup. Baeza says the 14 weeks will be organized to maximize the use of resources to develop a well-defined product.
So the first phase of it will be sort of definition. So as we were talking about, kind of that mentor dating and also really, really putting that concept through the ringer and making sure that it's targeted for the correct market. And at the end of week 4, we'll want our founders to really, really pin down a direction.
The program will then go into the execution phase.
In the directing phase, we would have a lot of different sessions, training sessions, but during execution phase where it's actually building on whatever direction we've decided, that is going to be a lot of just at the computer, pounding out the code, and figuring out the best way to make that idea come to fruition in terms of the architecture and the execution of that.
The latter part of the bootcamp training will focus on developing the perfect pitch and presentation for the product. Baeza says interested startup founders can log on to arcchallenge.org to apply for the program.
So if you go to arcchallenge.org and click on the Apply Now button, that will take you straight to the online application where you can tell us more about your company, upload videos about your team, upload a video about your business, and also just give us as much information so that we get to know your company, because that will help in the selection process.
The ARC is an initiative that hopes to enhance regional competitiveness by providing mentorship as well as knowledge and financial resources to technology startups, in addition to advancing workforce training development efforts. More information about the ARC or the ARC Challenge can be found at arkchallenge.org or on the ARC's Facebook page.
Several Northwest Arkansas residents are training to compete in the Tough Mudder, which brands itself as the world's premier obstacle course competition. Tough Mudders, headquartered out of New York, are held in both urban and rural settings in Europe, Japan, South Africa, Australia, Canada, and the U.S., where 20 races are scheduled this year. Our Ozark Mudders will be heading to Dallas at the end of the month. Jacqueline Froelich caught up with two local Mudders during training and brings us their story.
Keith Scheffler and Eric Walker run Lake Fayetteville Trail this cloudy and warm afternoon. They've been training since January for Tough Mudder Dallas, and they're running at a nice clip. Up until a few months ago, Eric Walker, 36, could barely jog a quarter mile. Now he's up to 4. The doctor of chiropractic spends his day at his practice, Millennium Clinic in Fayetteville, treating both civilians and athletes, including the Arkansas Razorbacks, which keeps him physically strong. It's a lot of upper body work, but his endurance was low.
I heard about it from a patient of mine who was training for the Tough Mudder and had a low back problem, and we treated him through that. He was able to complete the Tough Mudder and then came back and told me about his experience. And so we looked into it just as more or less a method of forcing ourselves to train to stay in shape.
His mudder companion, they know each other from church, is Keith Scheffler, 38. He routinely works out when not operating his Springdale-based company, Creative Things.
Really, another part of it, too, is we annually, there's Lewis and Clark here in Springdale, Arkansas, puts on the Ozark Adventure Race, and we've done that in the past. So we've wanted to do more and more of the adventure races, and this one kind of came up, except we've kind of jumped from the regional adventure race into this Mac Daddy big the World Series of races. So so that's kind of how we're doing it.
Mac Daddy, no doubt. At the end of this month, Eric and Keith, along with five other Mudder teammates, will head down to Texas to compete in a Tough Mudder obstacle course staged on the Freestone County Raceway in Wortham, outside of Dallas. There, they will face a 12-mile endurance challenge.
I'm most looking forward to the electric shock therapy.
I want to know what 10,000 volts feels like.
We are normal people dressed up like idiots, getting as muddy as possible.
We come to get dirty, get wet, have a good time.
The company that runs Tough Mudder claims the events are designed by British Special Forces with 25 military-style obstacles, climbing walls and ropes, water pits, a firewalk, electroshock crawl beneath a gauntlet of 10,000-volt dangling wires, greased monkey bars, and of course deep trenches and underground tunnels filled with mud. The brainchild behind this torture chamber, again according to the website, is Will Dean, a former counterterrorism agent for the British government. While studying for his MBA at Harvard, Dean was inspired to start Tough Mudder as a way to let off steam. The competition starts are staggered, with elite athletes leading the course. Springdale entrepreneur Keith Scheffler.
Because the event starts at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it goes, so teams kick off between 8 and noon. So if you can imagine, it's completely full. So every 20 minutes, there's a group, there's a wave being sent off. So now you can imagine, be like Black Friday, going into the store and trying to get that LCD TV that's $100. You know, everybody and their dog is there trying to get it. So it's the same way with this race. So there's staged intervals that everybody's getting kicked off. We're being kicked off at 11:20. So although yes, it is a race, we're thinking that it's going to be quite a backlog at the events or at the obstacles. So we'll have a little bit of some downtime there.
But these Ozark Mudders intend to push through, even passing some of the competition.
When you look on the website, you'll see that they have no less than, I think, 10 ambulances on the spot. So people are breaking arms and legs and straining muscles. So a lot of people drop out of it. So as they drop out, you know, only the strong survive. So Eric will carry me on his back.
Absolutely.
And all the way to the finish line.
With his broken leg.
Yes. No broken leg. Just my bruised ego, maybe.
Your bruised ego. That's exactly right.
Tough Mudder organizers claim their events are distinct from marathons or even Ironman triathlons. Those consist of a 2-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride ending with a 26-mile run. Because mudders, they say, are more about mental toughness, grit, and camaraderie. And mudders, turns out, are a diverse lot.
It's very diverse. Well, we have a female on our team, and she did the Warrior Challenge not too long ago. And you know, and she kind of gave us a hard time about it in that she's like, so you guys just all of a sudden want to jump into this race culture and you're going straight to the Super Bowl. You're not even bothering to stop along the way to some of the other smaller ones. So, but we do have female on our team, and you know, I'm just hoping that I can finish with her, and we can all finish alongside of one another.
And as a pack, you must hang together.
There's actually quite a few events that you need your whole team to get past. Like there's a half pipe that you have to get up. So you have to build a human chain to get somebody to the top of it. And then the strongest person gets to the top and then pulls everybody else up. So, I mean, you need a team. And when you start researching it, you'll see that, people that are running it single or doubles, that they will actually kind of pair up when they get to an obstacle. A team will just help them to get up to the top, and then they go on their way.
Seven comprise this pack, a number of the medical practitioners.
Well, we have your brother, Vince.
Vincent Scheffler, yeah.
Vincent Scheffler, who's a chiropractor in Dallas. I have one of my good friends from Clinton, Arkansas, David Warren, who's a chiropractor. His brother, Denny Warren, quite possibly may or may not compete with us. He's a chiropractor in Fayetteville.
His cousin,
who lives in Tulsa, and I'm not sure of her name, but she is in osteopathic school. Who else?
Ben Shaddix. He's a Fayetteville, actually Springdale resident. Okay. Myself and Eric.
And because they work as a team, Mudders need stamina as well as strength. The website provides a training circuit. Some of it's crazy. Which all Mudders, it suggests, should be able to do at least twice in a row before competing.
We've both taken different approaches to training, but different but still similar. Keith is doing the P90X program, and I've done the Insanity workout. Both of these are high energy, high cardiovascular type workouts. But really for us, it's all about finding time and making time in your day to be able to train on a regular basis. And so those fit in well. I can get up at 5 o'clock in the morning in my living room. I can knock that workout out. I've started running over the last couple of weeks. And so that's just kind of how my training has gone. But they have that suggested training, and I just don't think that fits in my schedule. I don't know about Keith, but for me, that very intense training doesn't fit in our schedule. Keep in mind, though, we're trying to compete. We're trying to enjoy it, but compete with each other, not to try and win the race. So the guys that are out there really training hard and they're, you know, swinging hammers and flipping tires and doing crazy things like that, they're probably more or less trying to win the race. We're not out for that. So we just want to have a good time.
What do you dread?
You know, the part that has probably bothered me the worst is the monkey bars and the rope climbing aspect of it. I don't think that getting over walls or cargo nets or crawling through mud, while that'll be fatiguing, I don't think it's anything that I can't handle. But climbing rope and monkey bars. And the monkey bars are greased. One of them is. So as you're going across them and you're pretty high up in the air, probably 15 feet, mm-hmm, 10, 15 mm-hmm. feet, one of them is greased. So somewhere along the way, you've got to know how to grip that. I'm probably going swimming on that one. That's what I figure.
See, for me, it's totally different because my dread is the ice-cold water that they put in there because I was frostbitten in the military, so I get cold very quickly. And when I get cold, I don't warm up. So that, for me, is probably the biggest thing. I may fake a leg injury and get around that one.
Dreading monkey bars. That's like a weird dream. Anyway, the tradition after completing a Tough Mudder is to drink beer and groove to a live band, because another tradition has many mudders dressing up. Awards are given to the best and worst costume, least clothing, and the most likely to have been in the Village People. The top 5% of finishers go on to the world's toughest mudder, a grueling, masochistic, nonstop 24-hour-long competition held in December in the middle of winter in New Jersey. But the best part of the competition is that a percentage of proceeds, $150 to get in, are donated to the Wounded Warrior Project, which assists wounded service members returning home from Afghanistan and Iraq. So far, 500,000 Tough Mudders have raised $2 million to assist soldiers. That's a lot of mud. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madholkar. This past week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda visited the Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale to take a tour of the new founder's room. Here's her report.
This is the entrance on this side and the exit over there, although some people, you know, do it backwards or whatever, but it's laid out as you walk in by decades. You walk into the 1930s.
Yesterday afternoon, Archie Schaefer, Executive Vice President of Corporate Affairs, gave a tour of the new founder's room inside Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale. The 1,500-square-foot room is located near the lobby and provides a look at the company's history and honors its founder, John W. Tyson.
Tyson has had a founder's room for a long time. For years, it was in our executive wing and was much smaller than this. And 2 years ago, Don Tyson initiated this project and wanted us to expand the founder's room and make it more accessible to both our team members as well as our suppliers, our vendors, our customers. And so we started gathering up all of the company history and photos to be able to construct what we have now opened and are calling the new founder's room. We talked about another name for it, but decided because of the history, everyone was going to refer to it as the founder's room anyway. So we call it the new founder's room. And it is just inside our lobby and was opened in November. And we think it has been very well received. Lots of our team members who aren't that familiar with the history of the company, as well as our customers and vendors, really appreciate being able to walk through here and learn about how the company grew from a very small family-owned business in the 1930s to the $32 billion a year in sales international company that we are today.
The room covers the culture, history, and tradition of Tyson Foods decade by decade, beginning with the 1930s when John W. Tyson began hauling chickens from Springdale to markets in Kansas City and St. Louis. The walls are covered with written highlights from the company's history, old photographs, and various memorabilia such as an old khaki company uniform. A theme of red and gold colors similar to those found on the Tyson logo are used throughout the exhibit, which was created by a small design company called Circa. A wall-sized photo of John W. and Don Tyson greets visitors at the exhibit's entrance. In a back room, the area is dedicated to a large yellow chicken known as Big Red.
He has a red hat and a red tie on, but Big Red was a mascot of the company's from 1960 until sometime in the 70s. And we have, you know, one of an old wooden logo of his that hung in the old corporate headquarters at one time. And it hangs in the theater we have here. We have a very small theater that we can show videos of the company. And we have that big logo of Big Red hanging in there, and so we call it the Big Red Theater.
The 1974 corporate film features rare video interviews with Don Tyson, Leland Tollett, and Buddy Ray. The light fixture in the theater was fashioned from an authentic chick house brooder. Other highlights of the exhibit include Don's last Tyson ID badge, a life-size cutout of Don, a memorial wall featuring handwritten notes from his 1995 retirement speech, the history of the Tyson logo, a story behind the khaki company uniform, and a replica of John W. Tyson's office on Emma Avenue in Springdale.
In the replica office of our founder, Mr. Tyson, we only had two photos that showed what that really looked like, and there were some things hanging on the wall in those photos that we didn't have and didn't know where they were, so we had to figure out how to come up with the three things that you see hanging on the wall, one of which was a plaque that had been presented to Mr. Tyson back in the 60s by Van Tress Breeding Company. And coming up with one of those to hang on the wall was probably the biggest challenge as far as finding something. And we ended up finding it by letting people know, and one of our team members who works for Cobb Van Tress that we own now, actually his father had a plaque very similar to that one and called up and gave it to us.
Archie says gathering all the materials was a challenge because although they had items in storage, a lot of it wasn't well cataloged. He says the current exhibit only features about 10% of the items they have, but everyone seems pleased with the result.
I think we've done a pretty good job of giving a good representation of the history of the company and how it grew from a very small family-owned business in the 1930s to the big company we are today.
The new founder's room is open for public viewing during regular business hours, but groups of more than 10 people are asked to schedule a tour time.
Last fall, the White House announced the launch of the Campus Champions of Change Challenge, which called for applications from students who are tackling some major problems, including sustainability issues, empowering low-income kids, homelessness, and hunger. The Full Circle Food Pantry at the University of Arkansas took the challenge, and after just over a week of public voting, found out that out of 1,400 entries, they came in second place. This past Wednesday, student representatives of Full Circle visited the White House and were honored for their innovation and determination. I spoke with some key members of the pantry. More than 2 years ago, the student-led Volunteer Action Center at the University of Arkansas began work on the concept of a food pantry. After months of research, Angela Oxford, director for the Center for Community Engagement, says they found great need in the U of A community. That, contrary to what many believe, even with student loans, grants, scholarships, and meal plans, students were going hungry.
Today's student is not, they don't have the same experience as students from 5, 10, 15 years ago. And that's what I'm finding. So many students, we have single parents, a lot of single parents who are going to school, back in school. Their Pell Grants are not as large as they have been in the past. And so more and more students are, the money, you know, they get their Pell and it pays only for their classes. And they don't have enough to live on. And so, and then when they're working 20 hours a week or 30 and they're making $7.50 an hour, if they're lucky, it just doesn't go very far to pay for rent, gas, those kinds of things. So, you know, I mean, it's just a different time, and everyone is stretched. And we even find that we serve students that live in the halls because they have the minimum meal plan. They get 10 meals a week over 7 days.
Sylvia Tran was one such student, with limited funds and making tough decisions about what to pay for.
Well, you pay for school, you pay for shelter, you pay for electricity and water. I mean, those are the things that come first, honestly. And then you just don't go without food for a while. And I was one of those kids when I lived in a dorm that would go to the cafeteria. And after, and I had that the minimum meal plan. And so in order to have dinner or to have food on the weekend, I would make a sandwich, and they provided foil. They stopped doing that, though. They provided foil, so I would just pack it up and take it. And then I'd bring water bottle and fill it up with juice or whatnot from there. And so, and I'm not the one who does that. A lot of kids do that. They will just bring a bunch of bottles, take the milk, orange juice, water, and they'll bring all the food, the vegetables they can, sneak it in their pockets or their backpacks and take it home because they need it.
Members of the Volunteer Action Center, or VAC, began talking to local pantries and found that U of A students were visiting them. But they often had to wait in line, having to skip class, or weren't warmly welcomed because of their status as students. And so, last February, after a year of planning, the Full Circle Food Pantry was born. While they call it an emergency 3-day pantry, that is merely a definition. They do give out 3 days worth of food, but do not limit the number of times a student may visit. Angela Oxford says this makes Full Circle a bit different from other pantries.
As we visited other programs, you might be able to go once a month. You might be able to go every 3 months or once every 6 months. And I was like, wow, if you're hungry and you're struggling just to meet your basic needs, how do you keep up with where you've been? You know, I mean, how do you keep up with, you know, well, I went here 3 months ago. You know, that becomes a full-time job, just trying to keep up with how to, you know, kind of meet your family's needs.
In its first year, Full Circle fed over 2,500 individuals. Students, staff, and their families made up the group. This student passion was what led them to apply for the White House Campus Champions of Change Challenge.
The White House recognizes what they call champions of change throughout the year. And this one is a campus challenge in particular. And so in December, we nominated our program, just, you know, thought we'll just put it out there. And we never, ever thought that we would make it into the final, you know, 15. And we didn't even have that much information. So we really didn't know kind of the what was next. We just did it. And And so we got a call, I guess, a little more than a week ago, telling us that we would be in the top, that we were in the top 15 selected, and we would be in a national vote. And then the top five winners would go to the White House and be invited to be a part of a panel discussion about their projects. So we were excited, and our students worked very, very hard to get the word out and to encourage all their friends and family and the community at large to join in and help make it happen.
In addition to an article on the front page of USA Today and endorsements by Senator Mark Pryor and Chancellor David Gerhardt, the group relied heavily on social media to push the vote. A YouTube video was produced, as well as many Twitter and Facebook campaigns. Not only was Sylvia Tran once a student in need, she was also a member of the VAC that started the pantry. She now serves as social media intern at the U of A Center for Community Engagement. Through her efforts, the Full Circle Pantry came in second place, falling only behind the University of Massachusetts at Amherst Permaculture Initiative, a sustainability program that transforms grass lawns on the campus into diverse and edible gardens. Sylvia says that while social media helped them obtain second place, it also provided an outlet for some criticism.
As a social media intern, having to read all this, everything that's going on in the media, and all these people that criticizes that, oh, well, we're not going to vote for a pantry that just wanted to get to the White House. Well, no, we wanted to help students. That was our main goal. We wanted to help students, staff. We wanted to help our campus because we knew that there was an emergency and that there is a true hunger and food insecurity here that people don't understand, and that there are stereotypes about students and people on campus, and that we wanted to debunk that. And so this recognition really helped. I mean, this is now nationwide. People, we get to be the voice of all the other campus food pantries in this nation.
This is a very big deal to me.
That's Julia Lyons, a senior and Full Circle chair on the VAC board.
Sylvia, I think, put it best when she said, 2 years ago we were at the drawing board, 1 year ago we celebrated our grand opening, and, I mean, just this week we gained national recognition for what we're doing here. I think it's an incredible program. It's an awesome opportunity to be able to share what we've started here.
Full Circle has worked with other campuses in the past, but this has caused an influx of questions from schools about how they can start a pantry on their own campus. In addition to the national recognition, Angela Oxford says it has caused an increased awareness in the Northwest Arkansas community.
I met a woman in the community who I invited her to vote. I said, oh, hey, let me tell you, how would you like to vote? And she started asking me questions about the pantry, and a few days later showed up at my house with food, and we took her to the pantry so she could see it, and she said she found $20 that morning, and she went and she purchased food, 4 cases of vegetables. We were so pleased. But the thing is what I realized is this exposure gives people an opportunity to be a part of it, to be a part of the helping, and it also helps people to understand that this is not an easy thing for students to even begin to talk about.
Julia Lyons, the Full Circle chair, has been with the pantry since it was just an idea. She says she has learned a couple of things that she will take with her when she moves on next year.
Well, my next step is I'm moving to Little Rock. In August, I'll be going to UANS, and I think the greatest thing that I can take from this entire experience is probably quite a bit of humility and quite a bit of compassion. I've certainly learned definitely how to delegate, allow others to help you.
Representatives from U of A's Full Circus Campus Food Pantry visited the White House last week to be honored for their innovation and determination.
It's Sunday, March 18th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Muthokar.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us is Becca Bacon-Martin, Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, there's a cliche that good things come in small packages.
I've heard
yes.
it.
Yes.
I'd like to be one, but that's a whole other thing. The Arkansas Arts Council has been proving this for 25 years with their Small Works on Paper exhibition.
Hmm.
It can't be bigger than 24 by 24 inches.
Okay.
Bigger than a 5x5, but still small. And this year's will be on show at 10 galleries throughout the state over the course of the year. There were 40 works selected from 246 submissions, and 5 of those were created by Northwest Arkansas artists.
Exciting.
Cindy Arcega,
okay,
is one of them with a... She says it's mixed media, if you want to be simple. It's a collage with encaustic and oil. Encaustic is beeswax, heated beeswax, and it's called house. She says the ancient Greeks and Romans used this technique in their murals and sarcophagi paintings, but it's only recently become popular again, and the house for her is a symbol of the self as a container for life and the soul.
Hmm.
The second one is a photograph by Don House, one of my favorite people in the world.
Mine too.
It's called Swimming Hole Buffalo National River. And he says that he uses the small works on paper exhibition to test new things. And this one will surprise people because it's in color. This is from a new series.
Okay.
About swimming holes.
Okay.
And it's not only in color, it's a girl in bright red tights. So it's really in color. The third one is Stephen Wise from Rogers, who has something called P85 Houndstooth. It's a gouache and ink, and it's geometrics.
It's what in ink?
Gouache.
Should I know that?
It's a sort of like watercolor technique that he's apparently very good at because he can get bold color out of it. He's, well, has a Master of Fine Arts in painting and teaches art at 2 Rogers Elementary Schools, so he should be good at it. The fourth one is called Shack Growth. It's an artist named Sabine Schmidt, and it's a digital photograph. Really interesting. She says she's doing a series driving and biking and walking around the Ozarks looking for abandoned places that speak to her because they convey a sense of vernacular life.
I like it.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm.
And she is writing a doctoral dissertation in comparative literature and cultural studies at the university.
So she's a literature student.
Mm-hmm.
But also an artist.
Right. And the last one is called Matchstick Man. It's a photographic print by Victor Chalfant, who teaches at Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville. And it's a photographic manipulation, part of a series, that focuses on myths, legends, fables, and fairy tales. Very interesting. And he has other work at Arcega's on Gregg Avenue in Fayetteville right now.
Okay.
Small Works on Paper is on show at the Art Department building at Northwest Arkansas Community College through March 29th. Hours for spring break are 8 to 4, Monday through Friday, and then the 3 days of the next week, 8 to 9.
Okay.
You want to know what's going on this afternoon?
I do.
Please.
The Spring Antique Art Show and Sale, 10 to 4 at the end of the Ozarks Convention Center in Eureka Springs. $5 to get in. Trouble? Well, that's how much you want to spend. There's a choir festival concert at the Holiday Island Community Church at 4 with 70 voices. And the preview party for the Fayetteville Roots Festival is tonight from 5 to 10 at Greenhouse Grill. Tickets are $15. And the open mic part of the Goddess Festival is tonight at 6:30 at the Omni Center in Fayetteville. You know, they do Howl all year.
Hmm.
But the Goddess Festival is the only time men can read.
Really?
So, if you want to go and be heard, this is your night.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Although Michael Downs was born and grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, and earned his MFA degree at the University of Arkansas, his new collection of short stories, The Greatest Show, is out now. He talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellams this past week to discuss the backdrop for his short stories, the 1944 Hartford Circus Fire.
In July 1944, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus stopped in Hartford, Connecticut. On July 6th, the Big Top caught fire during a performance, and it quickly became engulfed. More than 150 people perished in the tragedy. That fire serves as the common ground for the characters in Michael Downs' collection of short stories in The Greatest Show, Stories, published by LSU Press. Michael earned his MFA at the University of Arkansas and now teaches at Towson University in Baltimore. He returns to Fayetteville Monday night to read from The Greatest Show at 7 at Nightbird Books. Michael was born in Hartford and grew up in a suburb just across the river from the city. This week, I asked him if he heard much about the tragic circus fire when he was growing up.
I don't have distinct memories of that,
But when I went back as an adult and worked in Hartford as a reporter, the Circus Fire came into the news. And it wasn't anything, it itself was not anything new to me. So, yes, I had heard stories, I'm sure. I'd heard it mentioned. I know, like, for example, my grandmother had a neighbor who used to talk about working that day as a switchboard operator and trying to handle all the phone calls that were flying around Hartford, people trying to find loved ones, the emergency personnel having to patch folks through, interrupt other phone calls because the lines were all jammed. So I'm sure I heard it made mention of several times as a kid.
What's interesting, all of these stories that are in The Greatest Show obviously have a connection, and characters have a connection to the fire. We do see the fire for a few paragraphs in the first story, but after that, it's more memory or physical scar for people. For stories that are so inspired by the fire, you opted not to write much about the actual event.
And it was a scary decision in some ways because, in a sense, what you would think is the most exciting moment in a book involving a circus fire is in the first story. And I worried about that in terms of the construction of the book. You know, what would keep people reading if I gave them the fire in the opening story? But I think I needed to write it that way because after a long career as a newspaper journalist, I had found myself less interested in the particulars of big events themselves and more interested in the lives on the periphery of those big events. As a newspaper reporter, I was always focused on the big event and the people who were directly involved in it. But I would often look around and see that there were these other little stories of people who were tangentially involved and yet who were changed. In the newspaper, we could never run those stories, seldom run those stories. They just didn't matter as much when you had a limited amount of space. And then the next big event was coming along anyway. So I wanted to explore more those lives in The Greatest Show than the moment itself and what led up to it or what have you.
Two of the people we meet in the first story, we meet again over the course of the stories in the book and over the course of decades. Did you always know that you wanted to do interconnected stories where there were people in it who, in a couple of stories, well, his sister, my aunt, died in the fire? Or, you know, it's almost a novel as much as a collection of short stories.
I did kind of, the book is, in its construction, is probably half accidental and half intentional. Certainly when I started writing stories, for some reason I had in my head that I wanted to do linked stories. And a wise man at Arkansas, Bill Harrison, said, "Don't think about that. The first thing you have to do is write a good story." And he was right. I was writing terrible stories. So I was concentrating on writing good stories. And maybe one of the first real good stories I wrote was that initial Circus Fire story. And when I finished that story and was fortunate enough to have it published and sent a copy to my mother and she read it, well, there's a little boy whose life is still hanging in the balance at the end of that story. And my mother said to me, "Teddy lives, doesn't he?"
Hmm.
And I said, "Well, I don't know." And she said, no, "Teddy lives, doesn't he?" And so I understood then that I had to write more stories with Teddy.
There's a story late in the book when Ted is older and wants perhaps to go back to a circus. He's talking to a circus performer, and that circus performer says, "Oh, we know about Hartford, and we always try to do a better show when we're in Hartford." Is that a case of fact?
That's a good question. I don't know that it's a case of fact. I do know that circus performers know Hartford. They know it better than the general populace does. I know this because I visited with circus performers in Montana And I mentioned I was working on a book about Hartford and the circus, and they all, yeah, sure, we know that. So I knew that people in the circus world know and remember Hartford better than most of us do. I guess I just sort of thought if I were a circus performer, I would want to give it a little bit more of a push in Hartford.
The fire is the event that connects everyone. But to me, the starring role in the book, The Greatest Show, is Hartford and the neighborhoods of Hartford, because that's what people really have in common in these stories.
Thank you. That's an interesting insight. And I know that for me, the neighborhoods of Hartford and the city and the people there are a starring role in my head and in my heart when I write. They have that place. The fire happened, but the neighborhoods, they go on, and the people there, they go on. And I think that's in large part what I was trying to write. I don't live in Hartford anymore. I miss it, and I go back there as often as I can in my writing. And I don't go back to the circus fire. I go back to the neighborhoods.
There is one story called Elephant, in which a father who was not in the fire, he was in the service at the time in World War II, but he's talking to his son who was in the fire, and he brags about doing something that most of us would think is reprehensible. And we don't know whether he actually did it. What was the genesis for that story, Elephant?
It was in part the first line. Sometimes I write stories off an idea, a moral conundrum, sometimes off a character. In that case, I had this first line in my head. And when I was 13, my father told me he shot a circus elephant through the eye, he said. And I just kind of went with it from there. The way the story shapes after that and becomes, I think, a story about not being there for people when they're in their dire moments, when you love those people and you can't be with them or you decide not to be with them in their dire moments, came in part from an essay I read from another writer who was exploring that same idea and was troubled that he had missed his own father's death. And I think I wanted to explore that a little bit, too.
Some of the stories, in 15 or 20 pages, you'll take us across quite a span of time, months or years. How do you do that in a small amount of time without making it feel too compressed, without making it feel like a legitimate experience for the reader?
Boy, that's a good question, too.
And do you know when you're doing it, when you're getting it right?
I know when I'm if I know when I'm getting it right, it's in part because I have good smart readers who read after me and critique for me and help me understand when I've succeeded or failed. But I know that what I'm trying to do in those moments is to deliver a sweeping statement of time, you know, years later something. But in that sentence, there also needs to be one or two very specific physical details. If I'm sweeping across years, I can't sweep across physicality of moments. There has to be one or two physical moments in those sentences that give the reader a sense that the time mattered and was not flown through. The characters did not fly through time, even if I'm flying through time.
Sometimes when I pick up a book of short stories, I'll flip through. I won't read them chronologically from beginning to end. This book should be, I think, I wonder if you agree, should be read from beginning to end.
I do, and yeah. I hope people would read it from beginning to end. I do think the stories can stand alone. I published every one of them separately in literary journals, and it was important to me that they stand alone. But in terms of the book, I've constructed them and organized them so that I think they build toward a kind of crescendo. And I don't know if I could say toward a meaning, but certainly toward what I hope is an emotional resonance that's not too much unlike a novel, but I think is different than a novel.
The first line of the book mentions someone's story beginning in 1936. By the end of the book, we're into the 21st century. So obviously, time passes. But there seems to be a lot regarding age in this book. People who are not quite as mobile, virile, whose memories are going. Was that a conscious decision to have us discover some people as the process of age is taking its toll?
It is. It is. And it's also in part because one of the things age takes a toll on is memory. And I don't mean even individual memory, but communal memory. One of the things that most interested me in writing this book, something I wanted to explore, is the way in which an event like the Circus Fire, like Hurricane Katrina, like 9/11, like the Japanese tsunami and earthquake, hits us and seems like it will never go away. And then, and earnestly, we want it not to go away. Sincerely, we want to remember it forever, and we think it left such a mark it will. And yet, over generations, even over the course of a single lifetime, the memory of that event fades. The precision of our memory of it goes away. And I wanted to figure out or think about the ways in which memory is kind that way and the ways in which memory is cruel that way.
The name of the book is The Greatest Show Stories. Michael, you'll be at Nightbird Books Monday night at 7 o'clock.
God willing, I will. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kyle.
Michael Downs' new collection of short stories is titled The Greatest Show Stories. He teaches at Towson University in Baltimore and earned his MFA while studying at the University of Arkansas. He'll return to Fayetteville to read from his new book at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville Monday night at 7. You can hear more from our conversation, including what he plans to read Monday night, in an audio extra at OzarksAtLarge.com.
The 22nd Eureka Springs Kite Festival takes to the skies Saturday, March 24th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The festival takes place at Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge. The free festival is for kite lovers who come to fly kites together. Kids can design and make their own sled kites at a minimal cost, then experience the thrill of watching them go airborne. More information is available at 479-253-6596.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences, pursuing peace through education at arkansas.edu/Fulbright.
The weekend edition of Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar.
And I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina, by the way, did you do anything last night?
I just hung out with my cousin. We went bowling and ate pizza.
Well, that's a good plan.
Nothing St. Patrick's Day related, though.
Well, you know, I kind of went and got myself some green beer, so.
Yeah? What'd you think?
It's interesting. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Happy Sunday.